So, that was my story. This is the beginning of the test, man. I'm KQRIW. You guys know why we're here. So, who's going to sign in with, I'm pretty sure KQIZ. He's the guy who rescued me when I got on the 449 machine. Because I had coverage on 449, but where I was, Mobile, didn't have enough coverage on the 25 machine to use my hand to target. And the, I was using the wife's car, so it didn't have a good radio. So KQIZ, thank goodness he passed the word on to you guys. I'm going to check him in because I think he's got a question. Who else wants to check in because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet? Please give me a call letter and your name right now. Wait for the beep. KQRIW, listening to the TechNet.
WHYY, Joe, yes.
Okay, we got Joe. Anyone else? Once again, we're taking check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment for the TechNet. Please give me a call letter and name right now.
WS2N Paul with the Space Report. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Paul. Okay, do we have anyone else? One more call for anyone who has a question or a comment for the net. By the way, Paul, WS2N, I'm pretty sure you've got the space report number 259 tonight. You also have a question. You want me to go on, put you on that list? WS2N, KQRIW.
More of a comment about this report about somebody that got electrocuted. I'm just curious if you've read anything about that.
Nope, I'm putting you on the list. Okay, so right now we've got John, Joe, and Paul in that order. One last call. Anyone who wants to check into the TechNet because you do have a question or a comment, give me a call letter and name right now. KQRIW, you're listening. We've got more than enough to get going for the time being. John, K2, India Zulu. I'm awful glad you were around. Thank you for your assistance. And you're allowed to ask anything. Even how to get rich quick. We'll try to help you on that one, John. K2, India Zulu. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Good evening. And believe it or not, I was just tuning the knob past the frequency, and I stopped for a minute. All of a sudden, I heard you call. I'm like, he needs help. Okay. I'm involved also with Army Mars, and they sent out a technical bulletin. And if I had your email address, I would have sent it to you, because I'd really like your input on it. I'm just going to read briefly. The following was provided by National Support Net Manager so-and-so. His team recently was working with a Mars member that suffered damage to his radio and computer equipment from a voltage surge that propagated through the universal serial bus connector. The radio transceiver in question had a built-in USB sound card device and rig control through a single USB connection. In this particular case, all the USB ports on the personal computer were damaged, as well as the USB ports on the transceiver. Let me drop it for a minute. He goes on, while USB connectivity with modern transceivers is clearly a step forward in station integration, this incident highlights why isolation between RF and computer equipment is desirable. Implementing proper grounding techniques as well as surge protection on AC mains and RF transmission lines are paramount importance. And he goes on to say, optically isolated transient surge protectors are available for USB ports that protect attached USB equipment from transient voltages. And the added benefit of these devices is improved resistance to the electromagnetic interference between the transceiver and the computer equipment. They go on from there, but I'm just kind of looking for your opinion or the people out on the net that are really familiar with this. Whether it's, you know, we should be buying optical, what do they call it, like to say, optically isolated transit surge protectors. Take cover.
Yeah, John, good question, Bob. I've had a little bit of experience with this one. Monsanto, among other companies, made a beautiful optical isolator, which was a 8-leaded integrated circuit chip, where two of the leads were the light-emitting diode on the input end. Inside of the chip, the light-emitting diode, across a only 16th of an inch or 32nd of an inch gap, some kind of dielectric material, fed an optical detector. So as digital pulses went into the optical light-emitting diode emitter, and the optical detector detected them, now many, many megohms of resistance or isolation between the input end and the output end of that device. It's an optical isolator sold by Monsanto, and I was using that back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, for a particular project on a spectrum analyzer being manufactured by Airborne Instruments Laboratory, the company I worked for at the time. And I was the engineering manager of a spectrum analyzer product division. Let me drop. So in theory, that optical isolator does a beautiful job, but there's a catch. That particular optical isolator with that, let me call it a 16th of an inch gap inside, and that gap is filled up with some kind of dielectric material. Maybe it was mica, maybe it was polyethylene, I don't know what it was. Maybe it was Teflon. It was only rated for 5,000 volts of offset, of protection. My 100-foot tower on 300-foot land, to my knowledge, has never been directly struck. At least I'm not sure of that. However, there was a lightning strike to the power line a couple of blocks away, and lots of people had failures of television sets, I'm one of them, computing equipment, and whatever. So through the 110-volt line, a huge spike of voltage arrived at many houses. And in my particular case, that huge voltage spike on the 110-volt line took all the computers in the house, raised them instantaneously to some very high voltage, and all the USB ports of all of those computers became inoperative. So to my knowledge, it was a backwards feeding situation where even if I had protection devices on the USB port, because the 110-volt line feeding those computers went sky high, I guess with the right kind of bypassing the grounding, that could have been stopped. But a simple optical isolator is going to give you some amount of protection, but only 5,000 volts worth if it's in one side, one complete integrated circuit chip. Let me drop. Now, if your USB port happens to have a transmitter at one end of a fiber optic cable, that's X number of feet long, and at the other end of that cable is a fiber optic optical detector. Now that the fiber optic cable, that can tolerate megavolts of voltage difference. So with a fiber optic cable in the system, you're going to get a tremendous amount of isolation. But with a single packaged operational photo optical detector isolator, you're going to get protection, but I am guessing, unless it's got a more exotic design than the one that was made by Monsanto, I don't know if you're better off than 5,000 volts. And a lightning strike in your neighborhood can easily give you a good fraction of a megavolt coming into your wiring and whatever. So those are some of my thoughts on that one. Drag your feet a little bit when we turn it back to you, John, and see who else has got some information on optical isolating techniques for a USB port of a computer or a controller or a router or whatever. K2IZ to take it with some delay. K2IZ in the TechNet.
Hey, great, Jack.
Go right ahead, Eric.
The thing that you're describing was not necessarily the power line went up to say 200 or 300 volts, was the power supplies and the computers are regulated, not to say that you can't try it, but when you dealing with a lightning strike, it's kind of all bets are off to a certain degree. One of the things about a USB port is it provides 5 volts for whatever device you're connecting, and in most computers there's actually a current regulator that feeds each one of those ports, so it measures how much current is being drawn, so if you overload it, the computer will tell you that you're using too much juice. And the devices out there that they do sell that are essentially, they're ground switches, if you want to think of it that way, where you don't get the ground connected between, say, your radio and the computer. That's generally a good thing. It also helps with RFI a little bit. But when it comes to big lightning strikes coming down your power line, you know, that's kind of hard to deal with. I mean, I'm in a broadcast station. We deal with lightning all the time. So I do some funky things to try and minimize it, but it doesn't mean that I'm perfect and I'm never going to have damage. Control IW, K2J.
Yeah, in my case, there was another aggravating factor. One of those USB ports of one of the computers went to a Cat5 cable that was only buried 1 foot underground that went from the house to the Radio Shack, a little shed I've got alongside of my tower in the backyard, 70 feet away from the house. So that Cat5 cable really was another great big antenna as far as the electromagnetic impulse, the EMP, electromagnetic pulse that happens when a lightning strike happens within, let's say, a couple of blocks of your house. So I had all kinds of aggravating factors, and therefore all of those computers' USB ports had to be repaired. And I'm not much sure. I don't think the power supplies got damaged in each of those computers in the house. We had 3 computers in the house at the time. All 3 of them, the USB ports, got fried. But the power supplies didn't. And I'm not quite sure. My son puts up all the computers in the house. I'm not quite sure how many surge protectors we had on the 110-volt line going to each one of those computers. I think each individual computer had one of these barrier strips with the surge protectors built into them. But still, as I said, a lightning strike hit the power line a block or so from our house, maybe 2 blocks away. It had to be in that distance because the fire protection code for New York City, let me drop it, says that a habitable structure alongside of a well-grounded radio tower will not be struck with lightning. So my house didn't get struck. I don't think the tower got struck, but I can't be positive of that. And if it was just the tower being struck, then all of these power line outages that occurred on equipment in the adjacent houses, 2 or 3 houses in each direction from me, had failures of computers and television sets. So I'm pretty sure it was the 110-volt line that got struck. So, lightning protection is a real tough one now, John, as you can tell. No matter what you do, particularly if you lived in a place like Florida, the lightning capital of the United States, you can do various things that will increase your protection. But you can almost never have perfect protection from a direct lightning strike. A direct lightning strike can be numbers like 50,000 amperes, 20 microseconds. And you try to come up with equipment to protect you from that. And it's a bit of a dream. Thank goodness that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen in our area. Let's see who else is coming.
Another comment.
Okay, Eric, go right ahead, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
Well, talk about survivable stuff. I mean, the transmitters that we have at Empire and at Lowell State, now Lowell State would get hit 6 or 8 or 10 times a night, and that was a big stick. And the transmitters don't mind it. although it is a bit of a path because you've got multiple TV stations going into combining, which is very big cavities, but it's not to say that you don't wind up with energy up into the transmitter. So there is stuff that can actually deal with it. But one of the things that I did want to say is that even here,
where we have the maximum kind of lightning detection, including what they call air terminal. We have a lightning strike somewhere not too far away, and have a piece of, say, Cat 5, and have whatever device it is connected to it have the inputs blow up. The typical thing is that happens a number of times. People wouldn't believe me when I told them we need to put in a shield of Cat 5 cable. So every time we would have a good lightning storm, we'd lose some stuff. But once I finally got them to change everything, that all that will always stop happening. And by the way, the USB ports are a differential pairs of the inputs. It's not like one side is ground and one side is signal. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get the speeds out of it. So essentially, you're going into a device that's a differential input. And it don't like big differences in voltages. Even though it's a twisted pair, it does act as a really good antenna. It's your RIWK2J.
Yeah, on that USB port, on that twisted pair, and by the way, if you take apart a piece of Cat 5 cable, you'll find 8 wires inside, 4 twisted pairs, and if you're smart enough to take apart a foot of the insulation and look at everything, you'll discover that there are 4 different twist rates on the 4 individual twisted pairs. You have to make sure that even though they lie parallel to each other, they do not couple to each other. Very crafty design. And so, yes, it's a differential input receiver on your USB port. But if both of those wires suddenly become 10,000 volts above ground, no matter what that receiver is, I guarantee it's going to be unhappy. Even if the voltage difference between the two differential pairs is a small number, you raise both of them in a common mode manner, 2,000 volts above ground. Unless there's an auxiliary protection in there for that, it's probably going to do damage. But the USB wiring, the Cat 5 wiring, really is an antenna. If one block away a good-sized lightning bolt strikes, it creates an instantaneous magnetic field that, by Faraday's law, will couple into every piece of wire in the neighborhood. And the voltage developed on each of those pieces of wire could be a megavolt per foot. Each foot of wiring develops a megavolt between one end and the other end. If it's not a megavolt, it's 100 kilovolts, but it's some very big number. An instantaneous, let me drop this. An instantaneous 5 or 50,000 amperes that can occur. Once in a while, the clouds become positively charged instead of negatively charged for mysterious reasons. And when they do, those lightning bolts that come out of those positively charged clouds are really super. They're extremely loud and extremely energetic. They hit numbers like 50,000 amperes real easily. So a 50,000 ampere strike a block away from your house makes an instantaneous magnetic field variation that, by Faraday's law, couples into every piece of wire in the neighborhood as if it's the secondary lead of a transformer, and the primary lead of the transformer is the lightning bolt itself, and you don't need an iron core in between. Faraday's law just says that you change the magnetic field and you change the magnetic field fast enough that that piece of wire is bathed in, and by Faraday's law you're going to develop a huge voltage between the ends of that wire. And unless you've got some extra shielding on that wire or extra protection on the ends, it could easily give you grief. So there's no simple solution for this one, as you can tell, John, but we can tell you some of the things that will help an awful lot.
No, I wanted to add one more thing.
You got it, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
A lot of manufacturers sell power strips with surge detection systems, and it's come in various different forms. The one thing that they don't tell you is that they're built out of MOVs now. Stuff that we have on the tower, like, for example, the LED lighting for the lights, they've got MOVs, but they've got 42 MOVs across it. One of the problems with the power strips and things like that, they'll put 3 MOVs in there, and it's good for maybe 3 or 4 hits, and then that's it. It's done. And sometimes you don't know that a hit came by, and you've already taken the light. So that's just one thing to watch out for. You can't be 100% reliant on a surge detection power strip because they actually have a light. It's RIWK2J.
If a fairly nearby lightning strike occurs, and there's a good deal of antenna wiring picking up the voltage hitting your barrier strip protector thing with the MOVs inside, I think you could make a rough approximation that each lightning strike is going to essentially use one of those MOVs as an arc over device. But in many cases, once the MOV has had a single arc over and it's given you protection, it then becomes essentially an open circuit for the next arc. So each individual MOV, in some cases, in the worst case, is only good for one particular strike. And then it becomes essentially an open circuit and no longer protecting. Is that roughly the situation, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
That's exactly right, Dick. A lot of the tower manufacturing equipment, like your lighting and that sort of stuff, you open their box and you see it's mostly filled with these little lollipop looking things. And it's like, you wonder why there's so many of them. And when you finally talk to them, you find out from their experience, the more they put in, the longer it lasts and the better it works. So, that is actually the truth. The devices are making today are better, but when you hit it with 10, 20, 30,000 volts or even a microsecond, they have a tendency to break down. K2RIW, K3X.
Now, if you're willing to spend some more money, the Polyphaser Company in Nevada, particularly in Nevada, among other companies, manufacture a more expensive device, which looks like it's a glass tube with a couple of probes inside with an inert gas. And I believe those kind of high voltage protection devices can take multiple strikes without being damaged. Is that roughly true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Actually, if you want a real breakdown on that, you download the Polyphaser guide. All about lightning. But yeah, no, they survive. But they give you the ability to replace that capsule because after X number of hits, they can actually begin to melt, depending upon the voltage that it's hit with. But you usually don't have to worry about those things. Those things last and last and last. But they do eventually break down. But that's kind of a rare thing, unless, of course, you're on the top of the World Trade Center where you get hit by lightning every time it rains.
I'm going to guess, Eric, that the MOVs are much more popular because they're probably 1% of the price of those polyphaser exotic devices. My guess is they're not as popular because they're a hell of a lot more expensive. Is that roughly true? KE2EJ, KJRIW?
I have to ask this question, Dick. Are we talking about apples or oranges? Because the polyphaser, their focus is on RF lines. MOVs are not good for RF.
I accept that. But if I took that polyphaser device intended for an RF line and put it on my 110-volt line, if I choose the right one, I think I'm going to get some protection. And now, if I'm willing to spend the bucks for that device, I'm now going to get protection that doesn't wipe out as fast as an MOV. Is that roughly true, if I'm willing to spend the bucks?
WHYY.
Oh, let's put it this way. If you're willing to spend the bucks, there are much more intelligent devices that you can buy at your power line. I've got a combination surge and lightning protector that actually runs, it runs for 480, but it really protects the line up to 100,000-volt spikes, so. But there you're spending some money. But if you wanted to put the gas discharge device on your line, they actually make them with a gas that's, I'm trying to remember the manufacturer, I think it's Superior Electric, with a gas node in it that won't get ionized by the AC voltages passing through it. And there's a threshold voltage of something like 5,000 to 6,000 volts before it starts conducting.
Isn't that close to the number where an MOV, although maybe an MOV starts conducting a lot sooner, is that true, Eric?
Say again, Dick?
Does an MOV start conducting a lot lower in voltage than 5,000 of that gas discharge type?
You know, depends upon your application. You get MOVs that actually fire off at something like 1,000 volts, and then they have different varieties that fire up at, you know, 10,000 volts or 15,000 volts. Actually, I remember on the transmitter that I used to have, we had MOVs on the secondary power supply, which used for the ion pump, and that thing ran at about, that was 7,000 volts, that thing. So those MOVs had to be at least 10 or greater.
What's the lowest voltage I can get on an MOV, Eric?
I can look it up, but it's around a kilovolt.
And in the case of a gas discharge tube, what's the lowest discharge voltage I can get on that one?
In the electrical world, they don't make them less than like 5,000 volts, but if you've got an OV2 or an OA2, you know, it's only at 125 volts or 150 volts, they make good regulators, but there's different varieties. I think the stuff that that polyphaser makes starts at around a kilovolt.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable, and the polyphaser device can probably take a spike of 5 or 10,000 amperes. An OA2 voltage regulator tube, you put 5,000 amperes through that, and I'm pretty sure you've got a lot of glass scattered around your shack. Is that true, Eric?
I've actually seen that happen. I've also seen it happen to mercury vapor rectifiers.
Was that an 866? I've heard about the flashback you get on an 866. The first high voltage power supply I ever built had a pair of 866s, and that blue glow was a lot of fun to watch. When you've got an amplitude modulated transmitter, as you're speaking into the microphone, you see the blue glow of your mercury vapor rectifiers in your power supply jumping up and down in brightness of blue. Exciting piece of physics to watch. I bet you've experienced that also, Eric. KQEJ, KQRIW.
No, if you go back 20 years, there was a 10 kilowatt AM transmitter that I was working on, and I think it had 12 of those things in a panel, and it's like a light show.
Mercury vapor rectifiers were very efficient. I think their voltage drop is like 30 or 50 volts on each half of the cycle that goes through them. That's the good news. But they have a peak inverse voltage rating. If you exceed that, you get a flashback in one of those. You're going to get smoke and flames if you don't have a good fast fuse on the system. So Joe, what kind of protection have you used on your systems? W-H-R-L-Y-Y. T-2-R-I-W. You got it, Joe.
Well, my comment was, I'm working on a cellular wireless company from years ago. One company I remember that made the suppressing equipment that went on both 220 legs of the equipment to ground was a company called Joslyn, J-O-S-L-Y-N. And they had to be replaced every once in a while if you had a bad storm in a particular area, they would take them out of the base station. I think it was short when they got whacked pretty good in a fairly long amount of time.
Joe, that particular microphone on that rig is about 6 dB too hot. You're almost putting out square waves. Is the way you can cut back the audio on that rig here, Joe? We heard everything you said, by the way.
Really? Okay, how about this? That's better? The company's name was Joslyn, J-O-S-L-Y-N. I remember them from the cell site days. They were attached to the input, the 220 legs on the base down the field, and the stuff had to be replaced periodically in a very bad storm in a particular area.
Just about perfect audio level that time, Joe. Well done. Okay, Jocelyn's another company. Thank you for that info. So, John, we didn't solve your problem, but we gave you more information. K2IZ. And by the way, you can always find my call letters by QIZ.com. K2IZ, K2RIW in the TechNet. I said call letters, I mean my internet address. You know what I meant, John. I mean that. Okay. I said it, John. You got it, John.
Right, Dave, thanks. Like I say, this blurb came out. It's from the tech group, and apparently what I'm reading into it is some guy's station radio antenna took a hit, and it went over into the computer and fried everything. So all they're doing is recommending, you know, between the radio and the computer, optical, you know, the devices, isolation devices. And, yeah, trust me, I've seen all kinds of stuff with lightning strikes. This is something that when it came across, first thing I asked them was, this is, can this be information be passed around to the general public? Because the first thing you do is, well, you know, all the years I work, is you find a piece of information that might benefit a lot of people, you try and pass it around. I just want to run it by you guys first. So, again, Dick, you covered everything, and I picked up a couple of things like I always do. So I'll say, I'll turn it back over, and go on to that, and I'll say 73 is so that I can help K2RIW in the group. K2IZ.
Yeah, good question. Good subject, John. And please check in more often. We've got to hear from you. I know you hang out on the Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club repeater. I'll be by tonight. You went tuned by the 449-125 repeater of Limehawk. Awful glad you did. The timing was great. I had just gone through the harrowing experience of those super tight lugs. Super tight lugs on my spare tire replacement, a flat tire replacement. And I was already in my car on the way home, but I knew it was going to take me 15 minutes. Because that whole procedure of loosening up those lugs slowed me down by about 20 minutes. After I left the get together of all these hams, somebody got out to the parking lot and discovered that the tire was completely flat. Really needed replacement. Okay, next person on our list is Joe. Go easy with us tonight, Joe. Sometimes you ask some really tough questions. W2RYY. K2RYW in TechNet. You've got it, Joe. Wait for the beeps.
Well, I had a comment and a question, actually. What I'd like you to do just first, before I even do that, since you monitor multiple radios, go over to 449-125. And just listen to my audio over there for like, give me a 3-4 second transmission, and I'm going to come back over here, okay?
I'm listening there right now. In fact, I'm even transmitting to you there right now. W2RYY, K2RIW on both 449 as well as 2 meters. You got it, Joe. Okay, I heard your audio on 449. And my first impression is I think the audio was a little bit low. Give me a few more words. Very good audio. Very good audio, Rancho. So on 449, you're dead full quieting. Nice round sounding audio. W2RYY, K2RIW.
Okay, same radio on UHF on another frequency. You didn't tell me my audio is too loud this way, right?
A few transmissions ago, you were very hot. Right now, you're still a little bit hot on 2 meters, but go ahead.
All right, no problem. I'll back off the microphone. Make it a little easier on the ears. Okay, my comment was I was going to just give you a comment. This is really meant to Paul. I remember him saying something about him running about 45 watts from his house, and he had power station at Glen Oaks for like a length of time or something like that. I turned my radio down on my Maxtrack here, which is VHF Motorola Maxtrack, to about 2.5 watts, and I was able to sell his Glen Oaks, which is a slight bit of his behind me, but I'm on the South Shore, so he may have a very large obstruction between him and Glen Oaks to prevent him from hitting the repeater fairly well with 45 watts of the directional beam. My antenna's about 40 feet above the ground. Back to you. That'll come out with my question.
Yeah, hold on now. I'm going to let the machine thoroughly drop, and you'll soon see why. I'm checking on, there it is. 975-375 just came back to life during the whole last transmission. There was no signal on 975-375. Okay, so, Because I was doing that flipping, I didn't hear all the details of what you said, I'm sorry to say. So please repeat your message and your question. You got it, Joe.
I'm not going in high bay, that's why you're not going to hear me on 375, if that's what you're listening for.
Yeah, sure enough, when you're transmitting, I do not hear anything coming out of 975, 375. And I think that means that the people who are listening by Echo Link or IRLP might not hear your words. If it's not coming out of 375, that's almost always the time when the remote people like KQUPS do not hear anything. Over to you, Joe, KQLIW.
Well, that would be incorrect because I'm listening to myself on IRLP right now. I'm coming out of my own node, out of my own repeater on UHF, listening to Reflect the 9126. So I am indeed going through the entire system. I'm just not coming out of your repeater out east because of the particular mode of operation I'm in right now, which I don't have to explain over the radio. I think you can figure out what I'm doing. Can I ask a question now?
Roger, Dodger. Unfortunately, there are some people who only hear us by 975, 375. Therefore, they're not going to hear you. Oh, well. You got it, Joe. Play for the beat. You got it.
Yeah, the reason is I'm taping something off the air, and if I transmit on high beam or my disco antenna, it blanks up the TV converter. If I transmit on UHF, it doesn't bother it, okay? My question is this. Some transmitting tubes seem to last longer than others. I'm using a tube in my UHF transmitter, my repeater, called an 8072. I think it's a ceramic tetrode. And it has other tubes behind that, which are driver tubes. One's a glass tube, a large 12-pin glass tube called an 8156. Do they use different materials in the construction of these tubes, especially up the cathode, which will make one seem to last for a long amount of time and another one maybe not quite so long? Back to you.
Yeah, life of transmitting tubes, particularly UHF tubes, is a complicated issue. It requires a careful balance of filament voltage. And I think, and I'm going to check with Eric on this one, KE2EJ, that the more exotic transmitters have one filament voltage giving you a particular filament temperature when the transmitter is in standby mode, and when the transmitter is transmitting, because of back bombardment between control grid and cathode, extra heating of the cathode takes place, and a really exotic design transmitter will lower the filament voltage by a very specific amount during the transmit cycle in order to increase tube longevity. I think that has been done, let's see what Eric, and particularly on UHF transmitters. I know that there was a section on the 4CX250B tube. When you read the RCA transmitting tube manual, they did recommend on 500 megacycle service with X number of watts of drive on the control grid that the filament should be lowered by this particular, the filament voltage should be lowered by this particular potential in order to control the temperature of the cathode. An overheated cathode will have a shorter life. Let's see what Eric's got to say on all this, because with his very expensive broadcast tube, he really cares about cathode longevity. KE2EJ for any comments on all of the above. K2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2LIW, KE2EJ. Actually, we don't do that sort of thing. Transmitters are on 24 hours a day, 360 days, 365 days a year. There have been some AM transmitters that did a little something funky with it, because in some cases there is no cathode. But that's not a typical thing. Generally, most of our tubes are 7.5 volts, and we start them up at 7.5 volts, and then we walk them back a little bit, you know, a couple tenths of a volt to add a little life to it. K2RWK2, yeah.
I think you got to be careful with that, because I think the design of the tube, whether it's a directly heated filament or a cathode, a filament, a heated cathode, I believe there's a very specific temperature you're supposed to operate at so that the various exotic chemistry that's in the multiple layers of that cathode all bubble to the surface at just the right rate.
This is a manufacturer's spec.
Accept that. But if you think that you're going to get longer life out of the cathode by running it much colder, that might not be true.
No, it's actually the first layer of emission. You actually burn off a lot of stuff, and then you're into the body of the cathode, and that's actually got to run at a just slightly lower temperature, and that's to the spec of the manufacturer.
Okay, so after the burn-in period, if I understand correctly, after your break-in period, there's a slightly lower voltage you're supposed to operate at for that particular continuous commercial service of a broadcast transmitter. We amateurs, with our intermittent commercial service, intermittent amateur service, have something different. But anything that you do to make the cathode run a little bit too hot, I'll bet you can shorten the life of the cathode by some exotic exponential number, like it might be square law or cube law, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. They say, and this is off the top of my head, I can actually call up one of those spec sheets and instruction sheets that come with a big $10,000 to $20,000 on. You gain something like anywhere from 6 to 10% of its life by doing that procedure. And generally it's after the first 300 to 500 hours that you want to do that.
And that would suggest that there's some magic voltage and period of change of voltage that we amateurs should be doing with our UHF transmitting tubes if we want maximum life out of them. And where Joe is unhappy about the fact that his 872 tetro tubes are not lasting as long as he thinks they should, quite possibly the filament voltage is not the exact voltage that tube must receive for maximum life.
Yeah, but you know, the screen voltage plays a role in this.
Yeah, tell me about that. So, as you change the screen voltage, obviously it is going to change the amount of back bombardment, therefore excess heating of the cathode. So, I am going to guess that a higher screen voltage, which gives you a higher power output capability of the tube, probably has a lower amount of back bombardment of that cathode. Is that roughly what's going on here, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It also depends upon the fan conductor to the tube that you're working with. But there are some tubes, when you're running them in class B, whereas you hit a saturation point, you don't realize you're actually turning up the screen voltage a little bit. You start drawing more screen current, you start drawing more cathode current, you don't see it. But that hurts you.
Is there also the possibility here, Joe, of brand X, Y, and Z tubes? In other words, certain tubes, because of their method of manufacture, could have a lot more life than others. And so you've got a balancing problem here. I am guessing the tubes that have a whole lot of life might be the ones that are more expensive, and the more expensive tubes are going to be less popular because an economic radio amateur, when he's about to replace his tube, goes through all the catalogs and finds out how much each guy is charging for that particular tube. So there could be another complicating factor there. What do you think, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, well, the one issue that you brought up was in the amateur service. You're constantly transmitting, not transmitting. And that in itself kind of shocks the filament as the current increases and decreases and increases. You get the same kind of effect with light bulbs. You start walking the current up and down. We experienced that in the old days in studios because we use LEDs now. But you would actually shorten the life of the filament of the light by whacking it on and off, especially in staged theatrical productions where they're creating lightning and that kind of thing. So there's mechanical stress that comes along with it. So that's a contributing factor. I don't know how much of a contributing factor it is in say, a 6146, but it is a contributing factor.
W2RYY, Joe, when it comes to the 872 tetrode tube, that you think you are not getting the proper amount of life, do you believe you were treating it correctly filament voltage-wise, back off on filament voltage depending on UHF service as recommended by the tube manufacturer?
Also, is it neutralized properly if it's VHF?
Agreed. So neutralization is a factor, whether or not it's brand X. So what kind of life were you getting out of an 872, and what kind of life do you think you should have been getting. To me, 2LYY, KQRIW in the tech net, but...
Coming in via RLT, this is looking a little bit like the body on orbital disk. I have it able to come out of the repeater that's southeast now, so, as well as Echolink. I didn't say I was getting shorter life, I just said I'm getting a difference in performance between the two tubes. The 8072 tube I use in my transmitter is made by RCA. The tube behind that that drives it is an 8156 Compactron that's made by GE. It seems like the Compactron tubes don't quite last as long as the power tubes do, because the power starts dropping out, you find that you drive to the PA tube, it's a lot lower than it's supposed to be. You should change the 8156 to a newer one, or something in better shape than the one you're pulling out. You get to drive back in the power plant right after the 8072 seems to last for a very, very long amount of time. And that's a ceramic tetrode, I believe. The other one, I'm not sure what type of tube it is, because, it's, like I said, they call it a Compactron tube. It's got 12 pins on it. And the 8072, the specification of the filament is 11 volts to, like, 15 volts. I run the tube at the manufacturer specification for the power supply, which is 12.6 regulated. And that filament voltage doesn't change, and it doesn't get cycled on and off when the transmitter goes on and off. It stays on all the time. Being I'm using this in a repeater service, I also don't recycle on and off quickly either, but I tend to let it go up, stay up for a long amount of time. It's much, much happier that way. Back to you.
Got a comment about that? Yeah, we heard everything you said, Joe, but the system you're using right now, the peaks of your audio are creating a dropout for a couple of milliseconds. The rest of the board of the word was coming through, but you were getting quite a few dropouts on the peaks of your audio on that last transmission. Eric's got some words. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
I just wanted to point out that the regulated supply on the filament does not actually take care of the mechanical motions of the filament as the current increases and decreases. The regulator, of course, is compensating, but there's still this change at the instantaneous time that you go into transit, and the regulator has to readjust itself, unless, of course, you've got, like, double current supply that's supplying the filament to start with. So, but there's still that increase and decrease in actual current between the cathode and the filament when you're transmitting and you're not transmitting. So there is that factor.
I'm pretty sure some of what I'm going to say is relevant to filaments, but I know it's very relevant to the filament of a light bulb. In the case of the studio lighting that was being going on and off and getting decreased life that you've experienced, Eric, if you were using a soft start power supply for that lighting circuit, I think you could get extended life because
now you're not going to have the visual effect.
Agreed. But the filament of a incandescent light bulb can easily change 10 to 1 or 12 to 1 in resistance between cold and hot. Therefore, the inrush current can be huge, 10 or 12 times normal. And that gives a very heavy stress to that filament. If you had a soft start that brought that filament up in half a second as opposed to a millisecond, I bet you can double the life of tubes that are being used in a flashing manner. KQEJ for a comment, KQRIW.
KQRIW, KQEJ. Well, let me tell you, the UHF IoT, or you can call it Electron if you want, that's a three-stage step start. That's a 46,000 tube. I'm just going to protect it. I mean, there is a deuterium-filled Thyrotron just to protect it from arc over. And it's a real fast crowbar. I mean, it fires in less than 200 microseconds. So, boy, does that thing make a big bang when it goes off. But you actually, even in the VHF transmitters, that's a single-stage step start to bring it up. And generally, these transmitters don't, from the time that you hit the start button until the time they go on the air, it's usually like in an order of 30 seconds to a minute. Most transmitters have an emergency fast start which will start the transmitter up in like 5 seconds, but you're begging the life of the tube by doing that.
I'm going to throw in a couple of words here on the crowbar circuit. In the case of high vacuum large tubes like traveling wave tube and Klystron, the recommendation if the tube has been sitting on the shelf for a month or longer, you should really use a wake-up procedure. That's where you put air and filament voltage onto the tube for some significant number of hours before you hit it with high voltage. Because unless the tube was made under the most ideal conditions, all of that hardware that's inside that vacuum is always outgassing. So the amount of outgassing that's been sitting on the shelf for a few months could be such that when you hit it with high voltage, you'll get an arc over. Every single arc over of high voltage inside of a Klystron traveling wave tube or any other kind of a large high vacuum tube, every arc over is destructive. You're taking all of that stored energy that's in your many microfarads of thousands of volt capacitors on that power supply, and you're discharging it across that arc, and that creates sputtering. In other words, you're literally burning away portions of wherever the arc happened to occur. You're burning away some of the innards of that tube and electroplating it all over the place, as if you're trying to do, the thin layers of coatings you put on lenses is done by a vacuum sputtering process. So every arc over inside of the tube is destructive. Therefore, if you're a good designer, you design a so-called crowbar circuit that detects the fact that an unusual current has just started to be drawn, usually meaning that it's an arc over, and it takes all of that stored energy of those capacitors and puts a direct short circuit across them in microseconds. You want all that energy of your stored energy of your high voltage electrolytic capacitors. You want that to go into the crowbar circuit, not into the arc and
repeater. Time out.
You want all of that energy to go into your crowbar circuit, not into the arc that's inside your tube. You're trying to limit the amount of damage. So crowbar circuits on very expensive tubes, like traveling wave and Klystron, is a very valuable circuit. The next thing you've got to worry about is false alarming in that circuit. And there's some kind of a peculiar characteristic when it comes to the inverter-type high-voltage power supply that's used on many traveling wave tubes. When you fire that from a normal 110-volt line, that circuit that's measuring the Helix current, Helix current in many cases is not supposed to exceed more than 10 milliamperes, otherwise you're going to burn up the Helix, because it's running at 5,000 volts below ground, the cathode is. And so you've got a circuit in there that tries to measure Helix current, and if anything's wrong, it'll kill the power supply, it'll put it into a standby mode. Well, many of these traveling wave tube power supplies work beautiful on a nice, pure 60-cycle power line, but you run them on a motor generator set. For reasons that are a little bit mysterious to me, a tremendous number of microwave ham radio operators in the field running on motor generator power have false alarms of that Helix current detecting circuit, and so the high-voltage power supply is continuously tripping out. And I don't know if any of the microwavers have done a serious investigation to find out what's going on there. I know we're off subject, but in your particular case, I think you said it was 8072 tube that you were talking about, not an 872. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, again, the output tube is 8072. That would be used in early GE master prototype transmitters, and the driver for that tube is an 8156 type of tube. And basically, like I said, what I've noticed is the 8156 doesn't near as long as the 8072. And it's not being driven very hard. Power-wise, I don't think it's being driven by an 8102. The thing is, that's kind of funny with this transmitter, it uses what's called a Baraka tripler to go from VHF to UHF to develop enough power to drive the 8072 at UHF. But I tried measuring the power coming out of the 8156, and I really can't. It's not very easy to do that. So I don't think it's being overdriven, but I just don't know why the tubes don't seem to last as long as the power tube, so back to you.
So it's not lasting as long as the driver or power tube. Power tube is, I think it's the 8072 that's getting short life on it. How short was that life compared to the other tube? I mean, when you're getting 5,000 hours out of one and 10,000 hours out of the other, make a rough guess along those lines, Joe. Over here, Joe.
Kind of hard to get. Wow, noisy. Noisy.
As you know, you were very noisy.
Everything took a... Everything, VHF, we just still got noisy. I went into IROP. It's hard. I'd say about maybe a span of about 6 or 7 years to about maybe 4 or 5 years. How's that for timing? I didn't gauge it by hours.
That's as good a timing as any, because I think in repeater service, you've got that transmitter 24/7 at least in standby service and occasionally doing transmitting. Is that true, Joe?
Yes, that is true. And it runs about 60 watts out of the PA, which is what the rated power output is for the prop current for that 2 feet. I don't run the thing in mobile service, which is about 70 watts. So it runs at the right PA current by adjusting the screen accordingly to give me the right PA current reading on the transmitter strip. So not bell driving anything at all. That's the only really controlling element you have in the transmitter, just adjusting the voltage to make your power output go up and down. You can't change the drive limit from the other two people behind it at all. They are doing what they're doing.
On your next transmission, Joe, speak a little bit softer. The peaks of your audio are creating dropouts, so speak a little softer for the time. When you think the, whichever tube it is, the 8072 or the 8156, whichever one gave you decreased life, what's your definition of decreased life? If the transmitter is supposed to put out 50 watts and it's only putting out 30 watts, is that when you think you had to make the change? W2RYY, T2RIW on the tech net.
Well, it gets to the point when I can't hear the repeater in my house very well. It's a little noisy and slow. I know it was making it better before. Typically, I get about maybe 38 to 40 watts out of the duplexer and isolator panel, so with my antenna. So I can judge it from there, and I can take a reading from my house on the spectrum analyzer on two different antennas. I know what the signal arriving at my house is on two different antennas. When I see that change appreciably, I take my circuit equipment up and go check the power output. And like I said, typically when the 8156 starts to go soft, you get to a point you can just about see the measurable drive going to the 8072. And the 8072 just simply doesn't put out the power anymore. Maybe instead of putting out 40 watts out of the transmitter, out to the antenna, it maybe is putting out about 10 or 15 watts. So it drops down, noticeably when the 8156 starts getting soft and not producing much drive. So I change the 8156 drive right back up. So the 8072 seems to outlast the other two by a factor pretty close to 2 to 1.
You spoke a little bit softer that time, and the amount of dropout on the peaks of the audio was slightly decreased, but there's still a significant amount of dropout there with that particular arrangement. All of your words came through, but we hear these clicks of the audio dropping out for milliseconds at a time on the peaks of audio. And 40 watts out of the transmitter down to 10 watts, now that's a lot of drop off, and that would alarm me. If it's a 40 watt transmitter down to 30 watts, there are people who get very alarmed by that, and that's only a couple of dB of drop. The average guy listening to the repeater will never even know the difference, but 40 watts down to 10, that's a 6 dB drop. That's one S unit. That's one quarter power. That's a lot. And I guess any attempt to retune to peak up the transmitter line, I guess, didn't do it. If you had a chance to try that, Joe, there's always some possibility the tube changes the tuning. But, and I guess there's even some possibility that gas is getting into those tubes, but if they're a good manufacturer, that shouldn't be happening. So it's still a little bit of a mystery. So only a couple of years of when you think you should be getting more years out of that tube. In the case of molar rotors, transmitter strips that they've built